My name is Richard Hill, and this is First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio. We just finished up our copacetic jazz set with another cut from Super Standard Super Trio, featuring Kenny Barron on piano, Jay Leonhardt on bass, and Al Foster on drums. And now we're starting our All Things Cannabis segment. Terry Hopper is strapped in and got his seatbelt on, and I need one too, I think. Hi. Thanks for coming down. Really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Nice walk from the train even, too.
Oh, from the train. I thought you walked from Hamden.
Oh, no, no, no.
Okay. So we actually had a conversation of this type 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
When the landscape had just changed and the medical marijuana clinics were open and actually pretty much at cruising speed. And here it is a couple of years later, and we're facing a new potential landscape in terms of recreational marijuana, possibly in Connecticut. We now have recreational marijuana in Massachusetts. It's also on the radar in New York State. Why don't you just give us an update on what's happened in this past year in terms of these kinds of developments?
Okay, well, it's amazing, isn't it? Two more states actually have put forth medical marijuana laws, which are really great. And there's states you might not think, you know, Utah, which is kind of conservative, you know, and Missouri, kind of conservative, but they just okayed medical too. But right now for completely adult recreational use, we're up to Alaska, California, Massachusetts, Maine, Colorado, Washington State, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington, D.C.
Incredible.
And now the governor of New York has pledged to pass it within the first 3 months of his administration. And actually, the governor of New Jersey has pledged to do the same. I believe Illinois is looking into it this year as soon as possible. These are all recreational.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody
wants people driving through their state to go somewhere else to buy the stuff, right? I mean, they want to be able to make that tax money. And
well, you know, a lot of it is they've studied. Years have gone by in the legal states now, and the sky hasn't fallen. Matter of fact, in a lot of states, teen use has gone down. Opioid overdose deaths have gone down by 25% in medical marijuana states because there's an alternative there. So that's a lot to learn, but it just takes a loose attitude, you know?
Right. Well, so I think it is a major development that recreational marijuana has actually happened in the Northeast. It's now possible for Connecticut residents to get it right now just by driving up to Northampton, which is, I'll tell you right now, it's about 87 miles from Brantford, Connecticut.
Oh, and East Hampton, too, a third store now.
So the two in Massachusetts are...
There's three now in Mass. One just opened the other day, a third one.
East Hampton?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the third, the other one?
The third one, where was that? Like New Bedford or somewhere up to the east a little bit further, yeah. I think. Yeah.
In any case, we're trying to digest this. You know, people who, as young adults, were running around trying to buy stuff from dealers and that kind of thing. Now you walk into a store and you go up to a counter and there's a very nice 20 or 30 something person there who's explaining to you the products that they're selling, and it's just too much. I actually did it just to have that experience, just to be able to say I bought the stuff legally over the counter. But we'll get to some of the product information that I encountered when I went to the Northampton place. Why don't you tell us what some of the information that you've gleaned through your own experience, but also that's kind of coming out there about the products that are available in the medical marijuana clinics right now in Connecticut and how finely tuned they are to the medical conditions that people are dealing with. Now, we know that they just increased the number of conditions that are legal for people to get prescriptions for in Connecticut. But tell us a little bit about, maybe through your own experience or anecdotally, what...
Well, I have to say, I haven't been a member of the program since June because my car expired and the costs are just insanely high here in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the analogy. Suppose you had to take blood pressure medicine. Now, suppose you had to pay the state $100 a year just for the right to take your blood pressure medicine, not with paying the medicine or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what that's like, you know, and every year. I mean, that's really unpleasant. But actually, they haven't had the greatest record. One of the four growers, again, just got cited. They had a recall from some of their product because the tests didn't add up to what they advertised it was or something to that degree. You know, they match up and they've been called back for pesticides. My opinion is that in Connecticut, it's true to Connecticut. It's like for the investors and stuff. They had the original four growers and 8-9 stores, which they could barely support. They're adding 9 more stores now, but they're still not adding more growers. And their way of handling the medicine is not ideal. It comes out dry and it's not really sealed up. Very inferior in ways. Because most of the other states, they take good care of it and they give it to you at the point of purchase. They weigh it out, and it stays fresh right till then. Mm. But Connecticut doesn't want that.
Why? What do you mean they don't want it? Why not?
Connecticut doesn't allow that. They put them in the little pill bottles that aren't airtight and put them on a shelf. And if they're there for a month until you buy them like that, that's what you get. And the medicinal elements of it kind of dry out and they're not as effective. We've been complaining for years about that to no avail.
Well, as you mentioned, there are now 4 growers in Connecticut, and the state is about to approve 10 more dispensaries in the state. And the dispensaries have been complaining that they haven't been getting enough products to serve
as
the customers.
It is.
There are, I think, more than 27,000 medical marijuana.
29,500.
It's right up to
now.
That number.
Yeah.
It goes up every day. And it's going to increase even more with these new conditions. So the dispensaries are complaining they can't get the product. And the growers are saying, no more growers. We want to have a monopoly
kinda,
on the market. So how do you think that's going to play out?
Well, here's the thing. In most of the states around the country, they allow medical patients to grow themselves at least 2, 3, 6 plants or whatever. So in case the market is whatever, they're not going to be interrupted in their source. Connecticut's only one of like 3 states that will not allow the patients to even grow 1 plant for themselves. And again, I think it's more to protect the profitability. It has nothing to do with protecting the patients because they would want them to have, it's not going to make anyone go broke if someone grows 2 plants for their grandmother or something. It's not going to impact the market or whatever.
Right.
But in the meantime, a lot of people can't afford their medicine, so they just go without. They can't grow. You know what I mean? You're between a rock and 2 hard places.
What do you think is going to happen if recreational marijuana is legalized in Connecticut? First of all, these growers, they're going to have to increase the growers at that point, I would think, right?
Maybe, or it depends on the way the law is written, because maybe medical dispensaries will be losing half of their business, too.
Yeah.
Why go through all this and pay $300 a year and register and have the state know every single time you go to the store and how much you bought? And, I never felt comfortable about that. You're photographed on the way in, out, and all. That's an invasion of privacy you don't get at CVS.
Well, they probably do. They probably videotape.
Well, put it this way. They always were bragging that it's the first state with a true pharmaceutical model. That's why they don't have them in the jars and stuff. But here's the crazy thing. If I go to one in Milford, there's 2 in Milford, right? And suppose they were all out of my medicine and they had it at the other one in Milford across town. I couldn't go there. I would have to fill out a form and wait 5 business days before I could switch. You're only allowed to have 1 dispensary ever, period. And then you have to...
Okay, so let's just for a minute, we're going to get back to the recreational issue in a minute, but let's talk about what possible benefits there are in these medical marijuana dispensaries. Do they actually work to calibrate the products that they have to your condition, and how do they do that?
Oh, no, first of all, let me say they're wonderful. They're doing the best they can in an imperfect system, And the one that I had been, the pharmacist, and there's 2 or 3, 4 pharmacists in there that are very knowledgeable. And you sit down, have an interview with them, and they try to help you, based on, it's more like what kind of symptoms do you want to treat? You start for that and what kind of direction you're looking, what do you need? No, they were wonderful. I saw people in wheelchairs in there every day, and Vietnam veterans, and people bringing their grandmothers in. So things like pain all over your nervous system, that kind of stuff, back pain, spinal pain, it's doing wonderful for people. Don't get me wrong, I just think that there are other states that run the medical system a little better. Like Rhode Island allows community gardens where 4 or 6 people say they can't really grow it themselves. Well, they have spaces where people can come and community and grow them, and they get their medicine that way, and people help them.
How do they determine what you need in the clinic? And does it the product that Connecticut gets, it's completely dependent on these growers. How do they decide what they're going to produce to try to provide something that's going to have a medical effect for the range of conditions that they're trying to treat in Connecticut.
I think they try to have a pretty good variety, usually. Mm-hmm. I mean, like a few different of the indica varieties and a few different sativa varieties, but mostly also for people who don't smoke, they have them in salves you can rub on sore muscles, or they have them, you know, slip you could put under your tongue or something, or, you know, people who don't really want to inhale it, there's a million different ways, and that way you can adjust your dosage really precisely so you're not getting too much, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they really want to meet you anywhere, you know.
So, I'm not sure where the science is on this. I mean, I've heard these legendary stories about Washington State and Oregon and Colorado, where you can go in and say, I want to be happy. I want to laugh at a bunch of old movies. I want to feel positive toward my pet, and I don't want to get depressed while I'm high. What do you got for me? And they can say, okay, what you
Oh, yeah, they would certainly say, well, there's certain kinds that are mood lifters that are more euphoriate than others, you know what I mean, more energy-giving as opposed to relaxing. And, yeah, little by little, you can zero in on what's right for you.
So based on what you know about the science, like, how is that calibration done? Is it based purely on sativa versus indica?
Oh, no, again, it comes down to these things called terpenes, the different flavors.
Can you actually spell that for us?
Sure. Terpene, T-E-R-P-E-N-E. Now, that's a hydrocarbon, but that's a flavor smell element. Think of it that way. The same flavor smell elements that are in lemons or in roses or anywhere in nature. So these terpenes are also in cannabis. There's about 100 different ones discovered so far, but they also have very medicinal effects to you. Can I run down a couple here?
For sure.
I know this is kind of complicated, but there's so much to do, but we're learning so much, you know? For instance, like, these are the most common ones. There's one called pinene, which smells like pine needles, kind of, you know? And you find it in rosemary and basil and parsley and dill also. But it's good for asthma, pain, ulcers, anxiety, and cancer. Then there's the biggest one, myrcene, which smells kind of musky, earthy. And that's in lemongrass, hops in your beer there, and in mangoes. And that's an antioxidant, also for insomnia. It's an anti-inflammatory. And also that one sedates you a little. And that one actually helps you work with, and metabolizes the THC quicker, gets it in your system faster, and lasts longer. And then limonene, you know, you smell like a lemon peel or orange peel, that nice, that's the limonene in it.
So just to clarify, these things, are you saying you want to cure, like, some of those conditions you mentioned? You don't even have to deal with cannabis. You can go right to the lemon peel or the orange peel. It's what I'm hearing.
I suppose. Sure. Well, you know, I mean, they're still researching that. I think you'd probably have to eat quite a few lemons in one sitting, though, to do it, you know.
Okay.
You know, and then there's earthy, spicy tasting ones, and but you know, like,
so these are all in different kinds,
all
of cannabis.
Different, and yeah, in different strains. Say different kinds of pot you have. Some might have a little bit of mango and a lot of the myrcene, you know, a lot. So they're different combinations. So that's where you look at that too and say, oh, this is a more uplifting one. You could tell more predictably from stuff like this than you can from, say, oh, 20% THC is going to zoom you, or sativa, you know. That doesn't really guarantee anything. But when you see things like this, you know.
Where is this research coming from?
Oh, it's all over now. If you just look in terpenes, cannabis terpenes, anywhere, and there's just pages and pages of this stuff. And, you know, the research is ongoing, but it's become the accepted science in cannabis now, you know, that the percentage is only so important, but not really telling you much.
So let's go to the recreational menu that was served up at NETA, the Northampton store. They, for example, let's just talk about the buds for a second, the actual grass of old that we knew when we were teenagers. They have, I don't know, four or five different varieties. I'll just mention one, the percentages that they break down for you. So I'll read off these numbers and you tell me if they mean anything to you and whether they're actually significant. So they have it TAC, which I think is the total.
Right.
What does that actually stand for?
I'm not exactly sure either. I never heard it put that way, but
okay. It's I think it is the total psychoactive content in the material you're buying, and then they break it down to THC, which in this example is 17.6%, and then CBD, which in this example is 0%. And so are those numbers...
See, the difference is those are cannabinoids, you know what I mean, as opposed to these terpenes, too.
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but on that side of the spectrum, is this information useful to people?
More for people who want it less strong, too. You know what I mean? There's a really lot of people who need... And make no mistake, THC is medicinal. It's not just the CBD. So some people might need a little bit of it and stuff, you know. But whereas some people are comfortable with 30% THC sativas, that would give someone else anxiety. So, I mean, they see one that's 8% or 11%, you know what I mean? They would know they're pretty much on home base. In that sense, they're very useful, you know.
All right, so when you see this number, excuse me, THC, does that include sativa and indica, or is that...
That's total, yeah.
So that...
Either
it doesn't,
one.
It's not telling you what the percentage or proportion...
Oh, no, because it's usually... most of them are actually a mix, too. I mean, they have the pure ones, but then they'll say sativa-leaning indica, or they'll say indica-leaning sativa. So you get an idea, basically. That,
right.
You know,
right.
And even that, still, and nothing is really written in stone, because it has to do with... what you eat for dinner that day, you know what I mean? Your body weight. There's so many other things go into it. So, I mean, they can't really make a perfect chart of these things, you know, which probably bothers the drug companies. You do have to just try it a little bit and stuff, you know.
We're speaking with Terry Hopper about all things cannabis. I'm going to give out the phone number because there are probably people listening who have questions of the type that I'm asking about their own experiences trying to buy stuff or as medical patients and looking toward the recreational culture, which may be coming soon in Connecticut or it's happening in Massachusetts. So the number to call is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. Terry, has the terpene science actually found its way into the commercial marketing of this stuff is if you go to these very sophisticated stores in Colorado and Pacific Northwest, are they actually calibrating and figuring out?
Oh, you should find. Yeah, I mean, even in the Connecticut medical program, the bottles have the percentages of, say, the big five I told you.
Yeah.
Except they're usually 0.0. They're so low in Connecticut. No offense, guys. But, I mean, when you go to other places where it's 5% and, you know, and you see 0.01%. So
okay.
That lessens the effect so much, as well as the flavor. And, you know, it's just like stale. Think of it that way, you know, if you let them.
So that's something that the grower would determine that percentage in terms of the growing practice would...
And the particular strain he started with. But it also, though, if it's not stored well afterward, you know, if you don't store it well and you just leave that thing to dry out, a lot of these compounds break down and they evaporate into the air and then they're bye-bye. So, you know, you don't even really know. I mean, and in Connecticut, I mean, because of the demand, they have the dates on the jars, but they'll pick it and guarantee 3-4 weeks later at the most it's on the shelf for sale, which is so wrong. You really should be curing it for like 6 months, you know, because inside the cannabis changes happen after it's picked even to make it more potent and to make things come out, you know, and that's another thing too. Most people store theirs a while before it really changes the quality. And you don't taste chlorophyll and, you know.
How do you store it in order to make that happen?
Oh, you put them in like mason jars, everybody knows, and then just once a day you open up and burp the jar and then close it up again and do that for about, you know, a month or something. You wouldn't even know the same. It's amazing.
Wow. I just want to mention that I think the reason when I did the first show with you, it was sort of, I had had the show that I called, or segment in my show called the Great Tales from the Psychedelic Age. Mm. And people called up sometimes, or I asked people to tell stories about different kinds of psychedelic experiences that they had had. And so that was a pretty fun type of thing, a lot of anecdotal reporting about using different drugs and the type of effects they had. And so that's also appropriate tonight if anybody wants to call up and give us...
That's another whole subject, I'll tell you. Yeah. It's coming upon a new psychedelic age. That deserves its own discussion.
Indeed.
Believe me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I was just talking to somebody earlier tonight about the psychiatric use of microdosing of LSD and also like ketamine and other psychedelic drugs that are being used for psychological conditions like depression and other issues like that. Yeah, I want to mention this interesting thing about this course that is being put up at UConn stores, which is, let me see if I can find the quote. In the upcoming semester, UConn undergraduate students, hundreds of them, will study how to grow cannabis, although it says here not necessarily the kind that can get people high, also might mean not necessarily not the kind. That
right.
Can,
I think, well, it might be hemp, but they're calling it cannabis too, you know?
Well, I think they're looking at cannabis. Anyway, the professors believe this. Theirs is the first university course on horticulture of cannabis, and several others in the industry could not identify another one. One of the professors involved in this, whose name is Gerald Berkowitz, he took some students up to Simsbury, I think. Is that a grow site?
An agricultural farm study center, I think, I believe. It's a research center.
Oh, okay, so they're not one of the producers for the state. But he said that when he talked to the people up there that are doing the research and doing the growing, that these were all people that were growing it themselves completely extra legally and experimenting and finding things that they liked, you know, and that their friends liked, and they developed certain techniques, but it was all based on trial and error.
That's the thing, too. A bunch of admiration is due to the private people that have learned cloning and science, you know, the amateur growers over the years, you know what I mean, have worked out so many of these things and made most of these discoveries, you know.
Right. And so now within the legal framework, people are trying to sort of catch up to that, but also trying to develop the academic science that validates.
That's accredited, yeah.
Yeah, the stuff. So he says there's virtually a black hole of cannabis horticulture in the United States. There is no refereed science about all the claims people make about products. None of it is subjected to scholarship. For a university professor, it's pretty clear that we need to turn the lights on. So I think that's pretty interesting. So that's happening, you know, I guess probably this semester. It's starting at UConn stores.
I think I know somebody involved in that program, too.
Oh, yeah.
I won't mention it. Hey, good going, guy.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we talk a little bit about the conditions?
I have a list if you don't.
The new conditions. Why don't you go for it?
Okay. Now, don't give me points off for pronunciation here, because this is a real doozy here, okay? As of today, cancer, glaucoma, AIDS, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord spasticity, good job, epilepsy, cachexia, wasting syndrome, Crohn's disease, PTSD, sickle cell disease, chronic radiculopathy, severe psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ulcerative colitis, complex regional pain syndrome, cerebral palsy, cystic fibrosis, irreversible spinal cord injury, terminal illness, end of life care, intractable seizure disorder, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, hydrocephalus headache, intractable headaches, neuropathic facial pain, muscular dystrophy, osteogenesis imperfecta, chronic neuropathic pain, and degenerative spinal disorders. Now, all of these, the doctors have tested and agreed that there's considerable medical benefit to use this.
And I think the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those were ones that were just added this year.
Yeah, just added, right.
Yeah, so that's going to increase the demand in our state. And I think because
someone out there might be suffering from one of these conditions too and not even know that it's possible for them to at least investigate, you know?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, one thing is we should note is that this increase in the conditions that are allowed to be treated by medical marijuana does not include opioid addiction.
No.
It's not very ironic.
Well, we've been fighting for that for 2 years, actually,
yeah,
for opiate withdrawal syndrome or for...
But ironic in that you pointed out that the statistics that in states that have medical marijuana, the opioid, I'm not sure if you meant deaths or
the overdose deaths have gone down, and, you know,
by significant percentage.
See, that's a thing, too. I believe that a lot of these, like I was reading all these terpenes, and a lot of them have antidepressant effects. And the antidepressants you see on TV every day seem so dangerous. And then one night work, you might have to add another one to it. And, you know, the side effects might include possible fatal events. It'll kill you. You know, I mean, you know, oh, bloody diarrhea all day. Well, that's not so bad. At least I have clear skin. You know, I mean, you know, so they're scared to death that people could provide their own medicine that does exactly what they need without even being on the grid, the financial grid anymore.
Yeah.
You know, 100 years ago, the American ideal was self-sufficiency, the pioneer, you know, head west, and whatever you need, you figure out how to get it yourself and take care of yourself and stuff. And now we've been such an over-retailized society that they don't want you to have anything that you don't buy from somebody, and everybody's got to get their cut along the way. And so that if you find a way you can do it better yourself, it's a threat to them. And, you know, the biggest lobbyists against legalizing pot are the pharmaceutical industry, the private prison industry, and the alcohol industry, period. And that tells you right there, doesn't it?
Nails it. It's also interesting, as you said, you know, the pioneering spirit and, you know, let's go forth and find a solution to things. There's also like a whole parallel track to medically produced pharmaceuticals, which is the herbalism, you know, that is part of Native American culture and part of so many Native cultures, but also part of, I'm sure, the first immigrants that came from Europe. They brought a certain knowledge that came from their ancestors. And so this whole herbalism thing, which provided solutions for many problems, has been ignored and attacked by orthodox medicine, by, as you said, the commercial.
Right, because it's a competitor.
Yeah. And here we are now confronted with a substance that was not only ignored, but was deemed a felony deserving offense for how many decades. And now suddenly you see the profit motive is become evident to the big corporations.
See, that's a sad part. They won't legalize it because it's wrong, the person in the steel cage, for doing something harmless that makes them happy. But they'll legalize it because, hey, I can make some money on this. Oh, now you're talking. Yeah. There you go. 50, you know.
Market forces.
Well, that's like, that's the 21st century here.
Yeah.
But not for long, though, right? You know?
Yeah, I mean,
I feel hopeful about a lot of things, you know?
So just speculate a little bit about, we talked a little bit about the crisis that might happen with supply if Connecticut goes recreational. What are some other things that might come off of that?
Well, here's one thing to remember, too, that when a state legalizes recreational cannabis, it's not going to be open in stores. The average is 2 to 3 years before the first store. I mean, they did it, what, just this summer? And they've been open 2.5 years ago, Massachusetts legalized it. And
right.
I've checked other states, it's 2-3 years.
Right.
Because what happens is the prohibitionists lose the election or whatever, you know what I mean? Sour grapes. And then they throw legislation in the way to keep delaying, oh, we got to start it. You know, it shouldn't take you 2.5 years to set some regulations to have a retail store, should it? I mean, things like that, you know. So all I'm saying is, when it happens in Connecticut, too, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot, because then all these other people will feel free to maybe travel. You know, I don't know what, you know what I mean? But if you can't fill the need right away, I mean, that's why in Massachusetts they were having kind of like analogous to craft beer, like farmers markets where people could, you know, small, just family grow kind of things. And you're allowed to give some away to a person. Whether or not they give you money on the side is another story, you know, but technically you're allowed to give 1 ounce of it to anybody you want to, you know.
So tell us a little more about that, because that came as some big surprise to me when I was hearing about it. That's in Massachusetts. Is that also in Rhode Island?
I believe there are some too. They're equivalent to, like, I don't want to say too much, but like speakeasies in a way have sprung up, you know, against the law, where people get together in secret clubs and stuff, you know, through networks and all. But then it became a little more above ground in Massachusetts. So, like I said, I don't want to identify anybody, but at a fairgrounds, though, they had them once a month, and they had, like, bands play and hundreds of exhibitors and all kinds of stuff. It was really nice, you know. They had artists painting. You know, it was kind of like a little mini Vibes almost, except with a slightly different focus.
And so the people that were displaying and offering their samples there, these were just like very
mom and pop
micro growers.
Oh,
right?
Totally. Like two people, usually husband and wife, you know, not any big corporations or anything like that, you know, which is the way it really should be. Whereas in Connecticut, That's the trouble. So you had to put down a $2 million bond just to open a dispensary, like a $2 million bond to apply for a grower's permit here and stuff. And so the ones who got the grower's permits are all investors groups. You know, there's no way for the people who've actually learned all this stuff and are the best about it to be integrated into it. That's why, like, New York and a lot of places are saying include the African-American community, because they've been disproportionately, you know, hit by it. I mean, you know, they arrested, what, 80% of the time, and we both smoke the same rate, you know? And so they're saying, why not let small businesses get into it there, you know? And in California, they're having that debate, too, as there's bigger cannabis corporations, but the mom-and-pop places, some of them have been doing it off the books for three generations, and they're like, well, it's legal now. We should be able to come out and get credit for what we're doing and stuff, you know, instead of having to go to the back of the line. So there's a lot of things to work out yet, you know, for sure, you know, and they're changing fast, too. So
talk a little bit more about these mom-and-pop growers in Massachusetts, no doubt, globally. How did they, I understand that you showed me a photo of the different varieties that they were offering at one booth, and they would look like they were about 30 or 40. How did they come up with these different things, and how did they determine their effect? Is it all just their own trial and error experience?
Well, you know, there's certain parent strains or certain basic, like, kinds of pot, I'm trying to put it away, people understand, that were like the parents that were really well known for certain characteristics, like this kind, Northern Lights, or, and so people have combined the more prominent ones to come out with their own brand new strains. A lot of crossbreeding and hybridizing there, and mostly experimenting. And then people trade seeds across the world, I believe. I'm not sure if that's legal either or not, but you know, or people go to the countries and bring seeds back from Africa or whatever. So there's like always an interest in people trying to, because the more varieties available, the more likely you're going to have the one that you can tune into that'll suit, you know, your situation best. So, I mean, you can't lose that way, basically, as opposed to having six, take it or leave it, or three, take it or leave it. Or they didn't seem to have a very many variety where you went, did they?
No, I'll tell you precisely what they had. They had, of the plant itself, of the bud itself, they had 1, 2, 3, 4 different types. And I'm sorry, they do have these other ones here. So let's say 1, 2, 3, 4. They have 8 different kinds of bud. And then they have, you know, all kinds of other products that probably, you know, have a different combination.
Sure. Also, if you want to eat it or if you want to use it as a salve. Like,
for sure. They have all that stuff, vape pens and edibles and salves. And what else? They have Tinctures,
right, to put under your tongue if you need like a serious immediate relief or a pain or something.
I actually bought one of those, and I said, I want something that'll help me to sleep better. Mm. And he said, well, you want indica. That's probably what
that's,
we should
that's
focus
a
on.
Safe, yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, and he sold me that, and I'll tell you something, that stuff is very, very strong. I mean, like 2 or 3 drops,
yeah,
and you get zonked. You know, it's like a total body kind of cocoon feeling. And easy to take too much of that stuff. So, you know, I took that and I really felt, you know, I shouldn't.
Try toothpick next time, you know, let's do that like that. You can get a microdose, you know.
Oh, that's a good idea. But break it down again one more time about sativa and indica in terms of what we know about the effect on the brain of those two chemicals.
Right. Well, you know, the superest oversimplification would be that indica is like body medicine and sativa is more like mind medicine. In other words, like if you have pain of your skeletal joints and all that kind of stuff, or nerve pain, you know, then the indicas would be soothing the pain and stuff. Whereas if you have anxiety or depression in certain ways, you need a more of a mental uplift. You know what I mean? A euphoric kind of a thing. Or you just all of a sudden forget you were even worrying about something because you're so into thinking about something else that you forgot you were even sitting. That's the best. You know?
So that would be the sativa.
Sativa brands, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But, you know, many are hybrids that fall in the middle. They have the best of both. But no one can really tell you how it's going to affect you, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why it's good to try just a little of this, a little of that, you know? I mean, if you're persistent, you'll find things that, you know, that you'll really, if that's what you're after, you know?
Yeah, that's a
but
good
one. But like I say, nothing is really simple black and white anymore in society. It's a little more nuanced, as you said.
So flipping over to the CBD side of things, tell us a little bit about what you know about that. you know, that's sold at health food stores, has been for a couple of years, apparently. Is that come from a cannabis plant, or does it come strictly from a hemp plant that is, does not?
From a hemp plant, you know, and from what I believe, I hear that it's not as successful as true THC CBD, you know, which private companies can't just produce and sell now. So most of the ones you'll see there are that kind, you know, because THC works with CBD too, and it actually empowers it. So there is medicinal aspect to too. But, you know, CBD is just the biggest one. There's also CBG and CBA and CBN, you know, lesser quantities and things. But they're very good for, like, relaxing you, helping you sleep, easing pain, anti-anxiety, things like that. You know?
But what you're saying is that the CBD produced from a cannabis plant would be more effective for
one? Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay. So that's...
If that's what you were going to do, yeah. You know, maybe you were going to do it. Except for your pets, maybe you might want to give them the plant kind, you know, the non-psychoactive kind. Yeah.
Now, why would we do that for pets?
Because it's very good for like cats with nerve pain or dogs and stuff. I mean, I can't speak really detailed on this, but that's another whole thing, though. Yeah, they make it just for pets and stuff too.
Now. Wow, that's interesting.
You know, because a lot of things we'd like sore bones and stuff like that. Yeah. Whether it's a cat or you from walking up the stairs, you know, something like that kind of. Just soothes the pain, but it won't knock you out like morphine, so you don't know, you know, they answer the phone or whatever.
That's a good tip for me, because I have tried the health food store version of CBD, has had no effect on my pain issues, of which I have a plethora, but maybe I should try the cannabis version of CBD.
Well, I'm a shaman, not a doctor, so I wouldn't want to.
I'm not asking for a prescription. No, I'm just saying, I think you gave me a good tip there.
So, like I say, it's complicated for sure, but it doesn't mean that the answers aren't easily gatherable, you know?
Yeah, well, it does sound, I think the point you're making is really well taken, that everybody's nervous system is different, everybody's weight is different, everybody's ability to absorb things and their sensitivity to medication. I happen to be very sensitive to medication. So when I did that,
man,
that indica thing,
night.
I was sort of hungover for like 3 days.
Wow.
Literally. I was,
yeah, you probably took a good spoonful or
but
something.
But, you know, I didn't really. I only took about 4 drops, but the suggested dosage is 5 or 6. So.
Oh!
So it's a good thing I was cautious.
But again, you know, nothing, you really can't write a rule. It's every person's body. You know, only your key will fit in your lock when you get home, right? You know, that's kind of what the mind and body is like, you know?
Just give you a perspective on in terms of where we stand in the kind of research that has been done and that is still needed to fine-tune the medical application of the drug or just the self-medication in terms of I'm an artist, I want to be more creative, I'm a musician, I want to...
Really? Lessen inhibitions too.
Yes,
so you don't,
yeah,
you know,
or right, I'm overcome.
Like for me, what it does is it overcomes the instant self-judging kind of thing. You know what I mean? Where you're micromanaging when I'm playing, when I want to, you know, and it gets in the way. It's better just to, all of a sudden you forget you're even playing and the music's coming out from somewhere else, you know, and you're not in, that's the ideal creativity for me.
Oh yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Terry Hopper is a percussionist and he's also a composer. You want to share an anecdote or two about using marijuana for that purpose? You just sort of did, but maybe you have a more vivid...
I can't really say it much better than that, you know? I mean, it's like a ritual for me. I do my creation mostly at like 1 o'clock, 3, 4 in the morning. But this is my synthesizer composing, though. This is not drumming, don't worry. But, you know, it's a good quiet time. But it sets me up so I can, you know, really just go into the imaginative zone without really thinking about being in the imaginative zone.
I think a lot of people are still mystified. I've talked to people 20 years older than me who missed the Cultural Revolution of the 60s, who, you know, they're like, what is this thing about marijuana? Everybody's getting, you know, they're kind of like acting as if there's nothing to it. And I think it's pretty hard to explain how this actually works in terms of triggering, I think you put it best, though, this idea of getting around that instant selfing thing that happens when you do anything. Oh, you're judging yourself, you're measuring, you're evaluating. But what do you think is really going on there? Is it that something is so fascinating, becomes so fascinating that you just literally get around the self-consciousness?
I don't know. Maybe it's like you're perceiving not from here, but from here or something.
What was those?
I mean, you know, perceiving not further direction. Another part of you inside you is perceiving the music, say, instead of the part of you that's talking and judging. You know, that gets suspended for a minute and stuff. And I mean, I was fascinated with the mystery of improvisation anyway. Like, where does it come from, you know, when you're not deciding to do it as it goes, you know, and hopefully you're not managing it, you know, you're just opening yourself up to a certain way, and it comes from this mysterious place. So achieving that place, or not achieving it, but just allow, not getting in its way, you know, that's the ideal for me.
Well, I'll tell you one anecdote I had, which I think fits into this. I used to be a part of a drumming collective in New York, and we would go and play from, I don't know, like 11:30 at night until 4 or 5 in the morning. And the teacher of the workshop was a pothead big time, and he would come and he would offer anybody who wanted to get high, and sometimes I would. And one night I got high and I was playing a very complicated pattern on a conga drum. And at some point I became incredibly captivated by the sound that I was producing. But I identified that there was this warm, pleasurable feeling in my belly as long as I maintained that rhythm. And I kind of said, oh my God, how am I going to maintain the rhythm? You know, because
I'm doing it right now. I'm riding the bicycle.
I'm going to fall down. But then I realized all I have to do is focus on that warm spot in my belly and I'll keep playing the rhythm. Because it was like I don't know what was going on in terms of brain function, but I had found another way of perceiving the event.
The music, right. That's exactly right.
And so it became a kinesthetic experience, which I could, and pleasurable kinesthetic experience, so that I could just focus on that, and that would sustain it. In the last couple of minutes, what shall we, any last comments or words?
Well, I just urge people to explore for themselves and think critically. There's lots of information on the air and being put out in the news, but a lot of it is totally false, and a lot of it has agendas too. So, I mean, don't run away with, oh, marijuana causes brain damage, new study. And you see stuff like that all the time, and it's just like, it's just crazy, you know. So, I mean, you have to be on your guard. But that's true for political news these days. It's true for everything. You know, people have to really sharpen up their critical thinking skills, you know, if we're going to set things righter.
And back to my question, what do you think is coming in terms of refining the different strains, their application medically and artistically or creatively?
Gee, I'm not really sure. I think they're going to do more study in the terpenes. I mean, there's like 85 cannabinoids in marijuana, too. And we've only studied 5 of them, basically, or 6 of them. So, you know, the others are lesser quantities but have effects. And the same with terpenes, too. There's actually 20,000 terpenes in the world. And of those, like 100 are possibly in cannabis, in various, you know, so there's just a lot of grunt work there, you know, basic stuff, I would think, you know, and people trial and error. And the other thing is, once it's legalized in your state or my state or whatever, that's not the end. That's the beginning. Because there's so many other people watching that who aren't convinced that it's a good idea and stuff. Mm. So please, people, act right. You know what I mean? That's part of it, too. You know, we got to show people you can be responsible with this and the sky's not going to fall, you know, and your kids aren't going to eat all your gummies. You know, you set a good example. You know what I mean? Because that's the way our community really is, that I know. You know, cautious but very caring.
Terry Hopper, thank you so much. It's been fun hanging out with
you. Thank you for having me.
Talking about it. We have some very shy listeners out there. Maybe we don't have any listeners.
Hey, maybe, you know, they've had too much champagne.
There you go. They're all hungover. My name is Richard Hill. Thanks for being with me tonight. And thanks again to Terry and to our...
Thank you.
And to our activist panel that was here earlier. And we'll be back the first Tuesday of February with that same activist panel and more music and other stuff. By the way, WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org.